Visit Hetty's Brother in Oklahoma. Visit the Bronx Botanical Garden to see the hundreds of plants there. So many resolutions, none of them ever fulfilled, except that one. In the end, though, she had done it alone. She had felt that water at night. That day, the third day, in the afternoon, he fell asleep and dreamed of her. For the first time since her death, she appeared young. Her brown skin was shiny, moist, and clear. Her eyes were wide and sparkled with enthusiasm. Her hair was braided and parted neatly. She wore the brown dress that he remembered. She'd made it herself with her mother's sewing machine. It was adorned with a yellow flower stitched onto the left side, just above her breast. She appeared in Rufus's basement boiler room, looking as if she'd just breezed in from a Sunday church picnic back home in Possum Point. She sat on an old kitchen sink that lay on its side. She perched on it lightly, easily, the picture of grace, as if she were seated on an armchair and could float away from it if it fell over. Her pretty legs were crossed. Her brown arms rested on her lap. Sportcoat stared at her. With her brown dress and its yellow flower and her hair parted, her brown skin shimmering from some secret source of light in the dank, dark basement, she looked achingly beautiful.
"I remember that dress," he said.
She offered a sad, bashful smile.
"Oh, hush," she said.
"I do recollect it," he said.
It was his awkward way of making up for previous arguments they'd had, tossing off a compliment at once. She looked at him sadly.
"You look like you've been living rough and wrong, Cuffy. What's the matter?"
Cuffy. She hadn't called him that in years, not since they were young. She called him Daddy or Honey or Fool or sometimes even Sportcoat, a name she despised, but rarely Cuffy. That was something from long ago. A different time.
"Everything's right as rain," he said cheerfully.
"Yet so much has gone wrong," she said.
"Not a bit," he said. "Everything is skippy now. It's all fixed, except that Christmas club money. You can fix that."
She smiled and gave him the look. He'd forgotten Hetty's look. Her smile of understanding and acceptance that said, "All intangibles are forgiven. I accept them and more, your faults, your dips and turns, everything, because our love is a hammer forged at the anvil of God, and not even your most foolish, irrational act can break it." That look. Sportcoat found it unsettling.
"I've been thinking about back home," she said.
"Oh, that's old-time stuff," he said, waving his hand.
She ignored that.
"I was thinking about them moonflowers. Remember how I used to go through the woods and gather up moonflowers? The ones that blossom at night? I was crazy about them things. I loved the way they smell. I've forgotten those things."
"Oh, that ain't nothing," he said.
"Oh, come on. The way them things smell? How could you forget?"
She stood, clasping her hands near her chest, emboldened with the enthusiasm of love and youth, a way of being he'd long forgotten. That attachment was so long ago, it seemed like it had never happened. The newness of love, the absolute freshness of youth. He was startled, but tried to hide it by making a pfft noise with his lips. He wanted to turn away, but he couldn't. She was so pretty, so young. She sat back down onto the sink and, noticing his expression, leaned forward and touched his forearm playfully. He didn't move but frowned. He was afraid to give in to the moment. She sat up straight again, serious now, all playfulness gone. Back home when I was little, I used to walk through the woods gathering up moonflowers, she said. My daddy warned me off it. You know how he was. A colored girl's life wasn't worth 2 cents. And he wanted me to go to college, you know, but I liked adventure. I was about 7 or 8 years old, jumping around the woods like a rabbit, having my fun, doing what I was told not to do. I had to search out quite a distance to find them flowers. I was deep out there one day and heard some yelling and hollering and jumped out of sight. The yelling was so loud and I got curious. So I crept up on it. And who do I see but you and your daddy lumbering? Y'all was sawing a big old maple tree with a cross-cut saw. She paused, remembering. Well, he was sawing it. He was drunk and you was a little bitty thing. And he was swinging you back and forth like a rag doll, working that cross-cut saw to death, sawing at that tree. She chuckled at the memory. You done your best, but you got tired. Back and forth you went, and finally you dropped off, and your daddy was so drunk, he loosed his end of the saw and stepped to you hard. He picked you up with one hand and hollered at you in a way that I never forgot. He didn't say but 2 words.
Saw on, Sportcoat said sadly.
Hetty sat thoughtfully a moment.
Saw on, she said. Imagine that, talking to a child that way.
There is nothing on this earth so low as a mother or father who treats their child cruel. She scratched her jaw thoughtfully. The world was just becoming clear to me then, seeing how we lived under the white folks, how they treated us, how they treated each other, their cruelty and their phoniness, the lies they told each other, and the lies we learned to tell. The South was hard. She sat and pondered a minute and scratched her long, lovely shin.
Saw on, he said, hollering at a little bitty boy. A boy doing a man's job, and he was a drunk his own self.
Staring at him, she said softly, and despite all that, you had so much talent.
Oh, them old time days is good and gone, he said.
She sighed and gave him that look again, one of patience and understanding, one he'd known since they were both children. For a moment, the smell of fresh red earth seemed to float into his nostrils, and the aroma of spring flowers, evergreen pine, cucumber tree, sweet gum, spice bush, golden rod, foam flowers, cinnamon ferns, asters, and then the overwhelming smell of moonflower drifted into the air. He shook his head, thinking he was drunk, because at that moment, lying amidst the junk of a basement boiler room of the battered watch houses in South Brooklyn, he felt as if he had drifted back to South Carolina, and he saw Hetty sitting atop her father's pony in her backyard, patting its neck, the pony standing near her daddy's garden, the tomatoes, the squash and collard greens. Hetty looking so tall and young and pretty, gazing out over her daddy's beautiful yard full of plants. Hetty closed her eyes and raised her head, sniffing the air. She said,
"Now you can smell it, can't you?"
Sportcoat remained silent, afraid to admit that he could.
"You used to love the smell of plants," she said. "Any plant. You could tell every plant, one from the other, just by its smells. I loved that about you, my plant man." Sportcoat waved his hand in the air.
Oh, you talk of old things, woman.
Yes, I do, she said wistfully, staring out over his head. She seemed to be looking at something far away. Remember Mrs. Ellard, the old white lady I used to work for? I ever tell you about why I left her?
'Cause you gone to New York.
She smiled sadly. You're just like the white man. You change every story to suit your purpose. Listen to me for a change. She rubbed her knee as she began her story. I was 14 years old when I started looking after Mrs. Ellard. I cared for her for 3 years. There wasn't nobody she trusted more than me. I made her food, did her little exercises and things with her, gave her all her medicines the doctor gave her. She was very sick when I come on, but I had nursed white folks since I was 12, so I knowed my business. Mrs. Ellard wouldn't go to the doctor unless I went with her. She wouldn't move till I come in the house in the morning. She wouldn't go to bed at night unless I tucked her in. I knew all her little ins and outs. She had a good heart. But her daughter was something. And her daughter's husband, he was the devil. That husband came to me one day saying some things was missing from the house. I asked what these things was, and he got mad and said I was back-talking him and owed him $11. He had a fit about that $11. He said, I'm going to take it out your next pay. Well, I knew what that meant. The old woman was dying, see? And they wanted me out. I had just got paid when he accused me of stealing that $11, and I only made $14 a week. So I gave 2 weeks' notice. But the daughter said, don't tell my mother. She'll be upset about you leaving, and she's dying, and it'll make her feel worse. She promised me my pay and a little extra to keep quiet on it. So I agreed. Well, I seen what they was doing. They didn't know more about caring for poor Mrs. Ella than a dog knows a holiday. They complained about her, throwed things into her food which she wasn't supposed to eat, let her lay in her own filth, and forgot to give her medicine and all them things. I was just a teenager, but I knowed it was trouble. However the knife fell, I knew where the sharp end was going to land, so I made ready to leave. About 3 days before my time was up, I come into the room to feed Mrs. Ellard, and she started crying. She said, Hetty, why are you leaving me? I knew then that the daughter had spit out a lie. The doorknob hadn't bumped me in the back when that worthless daughter was up in my face pretending to be mad with me for telling her mother I was leaving. I knew that meant I had just worked 2 weeks for nothing. I knew right then whatever little pay I was supposed to get, well, that was gone, see? She shrugged. I reckon the daughter's husband put her up to all the devilment. He was as smart as his wife was simple. I could have never thought up such rotten business myself. I would be ashamed to even think of it. Firing me over $11. The truth is, he could have said I stole $1 or $1,000. It didn't matter. He was white, so his word was the gospel. Nothing in this world happens unless white folks says it happens. The lies they tell each other sound better to them than the truth does when it comes out of our mouths. That's why I come to New York, she said. And if you recall, you didn't want me to go. You were so drunk in them times, you didn't know whether you was coming or going, nor what I gone through from day to day. We had to leave the South. Or I was going to kill somebody. So, I come here. I worked day's work up here 3 years, waiting for you to get the courage to come, and you finally did.
I did keep my promise,
he said feebly.
I did come.
Her smile disappeared, and a familiar misery climbed into her face. Back home, you gived life to things nobody paid the slightest attention to. Flowers and trees and bushes and plants. These was things that most men stepped out on. But you, all the plants and flowers and miracles of God's heart, you had a touch for them things, even when you was drinking. That's who you was back home. But here, she sighed, the man who come here to New York wasn't the man I knowed in South Carolina. In all the years we've been here, ain't been a plant in that house of ours. Not a green thing hung from the ceiling nor the wall, other than what I brung in from time to time. I got sick when I first come here, Sport Coach said. My body broke down. Course it did.
That's right.
I had operations and all, don't you remember? Course I do, she said.
And my stepmama.
I know all about your stepmother. I know everything. How she showed out to Jesus every Sunday and lived like a devil the rest of the week, doing improper things to you when you was but a wee child. Everything she ever done to you was wrong. The habits you acquired was put on you by the very folks who should have helped you be a better person. That's why you like Deems so much. He come down that same road. That boy was beat up bad, grinded down from the day he was slapped to life. Sport Coat listened in stunned silence. There was a hammering sound in his ears, and he glanced around the room, but saw nothing move. Could that hammering be his own insides? The sound of his own heart beating. He felt as if part of him were splitting apart, and within his old self, the person he once was, the young man of physical strength with a wide-eyed thirst for wisdom and knowledge, had suddenly sat up, opened his eyes, and gazed around the room. His head ached. He reached down toward the side of the couch, groping for the jug bottle, but it wasn't there.
Isn't it something, Hetty said softly, what old New York really is?
We come here to be free and find life's worse here than back home. The white folks here just color it different. They don't mind you sitting next to them on the subway or riding the bus in the front seat. But if you asks for the same pay, or wants to live next door, or get so beat down you don't want to stand up and sing about how great America is, they'll bust down on you so hard, pus'll come out your ears. She thought a moment.
The Star-Spangled Banner, she scoffed.
I never did like that old lying, lollygagging, hypocritical, warren-ass drinking song, with the bombs bursting in air and so forth.
My Hetty wouldn't talk this way, Sport Coat sputtered. You ain't my Hetty. You's a ghost.
Stop wasting what's left of your sorry-ass life with your shameful fear of the dead, she snapped. I ain't no ghost. I'm you. And stop going round telling people I would have loved my funeral. I hated it.
It was a beautiful funeral.
Our cheap death shows make me sick, she said calmly. Why don't folks in church talk about life? They hardly ever talk about the birth of Jesus Christ in church, but they never get tired of singing and reveling in Jesus' death. Death is just one part of life. Jesus, 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 all day long, the death of Jesus.
You the one that's always hollering about Jesus and how he gave you his cheese.
I holler about Jesus' cheese because Jesus could baptize shit into sugar. Because if I didn't have Jesus and his cheese, I'd kill somebody. That's what Jesus did for me For 67 years, he kept me sane and on the right side of the law. But he run out of gas, sweetheart. He got tired of me. I don't blame him, for the hate in my heart done me in. I couldn't see the man I loved so much, my plant man, stand by the window in our apartment, sucking on crab legs and looking at the Statue of Liberty outside our window, chatting about nothing, when I knowed all he wanted was for me to go back to bed, so he could let a liquor bottle suck his guts out the minute I gone to sleep again. The evil I felt at that moment was enough to kill us both. So instead, I walked into the harbor, and I left myself in God's hands. For the first time in his life, Sportcoat felt something inside him breaking up.
Is you happy now? Where you live now, Hetty? Is you happy there?
Oh, stop whimpering like a dog and be a man.
You ain't got to insult me.
I know who I am. Just 'cause you dragged Deems out of the water don't mean nothing. He was led to ruination by them that raised him, not you.
I ain't fretting about him. I'm worried about that Christmas club money. The church wants their money. I can't pay them back. I ain't got nothing to live on myself.
There you go again, blaming somebody else for your troubles. The police wouldn't be circling around the church now if you hadn't got drunk.
It wasn't my fault Deems started selling poison.
At least he ain't destroying himself by drinking himself to death.
Go on, woman. Leave me be. Go on. Get along now.
I can't, she said softly. I'd like to. That's the thing. You got to let me.
Tell me how.
I don't know how. I ain't that smart. All's I know is you got to be right. To let me go, you got to be right.
A half hour later, Rufus walked into the room carrying a bologna sandwich, a can of Coke, and two aspirins. He found Sportcoat sitting up on the battered basement couch, the quart of King Kong moonshine in his lap.
You ought to eat some food before you hit that Kong, Sport.
Sportcoat glanced at him, looked down at the quart bottle, then back at Rufus.
I ain't hungry.
Eat some, Sport. You'll feel better. You can't lay around and talk to yourself like you is two-headed for the rest of your life. Never seen a man lay on a couch and go back and forth like you done. You drunk already?
Rufus, can I ask you something?
Sportcoat asked, ignoring the question.
Surely. Back home, where did your folks live?
Back home in Possum Point?
Yeah.
We lived where you lived, down the road.
And what did your people do?
Worked shares, same as yours.
Working for the Calder family. And Hetty's people? Well, you know more than me. I can't remember.
Well, they was working shares with the Calders, too, for a while. Then Hetty's daddy moved off from working shares, and he bought that little piece of land back there near Thompson Creek. Hetty's family was forward-thinking folks.
Are they still living?
I don't know, Sport. She was your wife. You wasn't in touch with them?
Not after we moved up here. They never liked me much.
They're long gone, Sport. Forget 'em. Hetty was the youngest, to my recollection. The parents died out long ago. Most of the rest likely left out Possum Point. Gone to Chicago or Detroit, maybe. They didn't come here, I know that. Hetty might have some kin left down there someplace, some cousins, maybe.
Sportcoat sat in silence a moment.
Finally, he said,
I miss the old country.
Me too, sport. You want to eat? You don't want that Kong in your tummy without no food.
Sport Coat unscrewed the top of the quart bottle of liquor and raised it, then paused, the bottle poised in the air, and asked,
Tell me, Rufus,
when you come up here, how old was you?
What's this, sport? 64 questions?
I was 42.
I was 47,
Sport Coat said thoughtfully.
I come up 3 years before you, Rufus said. In fact, I was the third member of 5 N's to come up here from down south. The first was my brother Irving, then Sister Paul, her daughter Edie, and her husband. Then me and my late wife, Clemmy. Then Hetty come up. Sister Paul was already here when me and Clemmy and Hetty come. You was last.
Let me ask you. When y'all started building 5 N's, what did Hetty do?
Other than sitting around pining for you?
Well, she did day's work for white folks during the week. On weekends, she dug out the church's foundation. It was mostly me and Hetty and Edie, them two women at first. Sister Paul and her husband, they done a little. Sister Paul did. Reverend Chicksaw, her husband, he weren't too fond of digging.
Then the Italian came with his men, and some other folks showed up later, Sister G's folks, and the cousin's parents. But it was the Italian that got it going good. After he come, that freed us up. That's when Hetty made that big yard out behind the church that's all weeds now. She wanted a big garden back there. She said you was going to come up and fill it with all sorts of collards and yams and even some special kind of flower, something you can see in the dark. I forget what it's called now.
Sport Coat felt shame climb into his face.
Moonflowers, he said.
That's right, moonflowers. Of course, you didn't come up for 3 years, and you were sick when you come up. Plus, who got time to make a garden? You can't grow nothing in New York.
Rufus stood above Sport Coat, still holding the sandwich.
This thing gonna grow ears, Sport. You want it or not?
Sport Coat shook his head. The sound of hammers banging in his brain had returned. He wished it would stop. With a sigh, he stared at the jug of King Kong in his lap.
Booze, he thought. I chose booze over my moonflower.
He reached over the armrest and picked up the bottle cap. He gently put it on the bottle, screwed it closed slowly, then lifted the bottle off his lap and placed it carefully on the floor.
Where'd you say Sister Paul was?
He asked.
Out in Bensonhurst, near the hospital where Sausage and Deems is.
Rufus eyed the bottle of King Kong.
If you ain't sipping, I'll do the dipping, he said.
He reached down and picked up the bottle, took a deep sip, then turned to hand the bottle to Sport Coat. But the old man was already out the door and gone. Chapter 21 New Dirt. Potts drove past the Elephant's boxcar 3 times, checking the empty alleys and the nearby streets. He did it both as a precaution and to telegraph his arrival. It was early evening, and at this hour pedestrians at the edge of the cause houses were sparse. There was little need to worry about lookouts. In the old days, even kids playing stickball on the docks would interrupt their game to send one of their number dashing off, and the news of a cop's arrival traveled to the mobsters running card games and loan sharks faster than any telephone. Today there were no kids playing near the beaten, deserted docks, he noticed. And from the look of things, there hadn't been for a while. Still, it was never a good idea to surprise the Elephant. So he did the exercise anyway, circling the block 3 times before turning onto the dock where the boxcar lived. He let the cruiser drift slowly onto the dock, then stopped at the door of the boxcar and let the car idle. He sat behind the wheel several minutes, waiting. He had come alone. He had to. His suspicions about his young partner, Mitch, the lieutenant at the 7-6, and the captain above him were just too great. He didn't blame them for being on the take. If they wanted to climb up the greasy payoff pole, nipping a bit here and there from the family, looking the other way while the crooked bums ran their rackets, that was their business. But 3 months short of retirement, Potts saw no reason to risk his own pension. He was glad he'd stayed clean in his career, especially now, because a shooting like the one at Vitali Pier 3 days ago could touch off a drug war or a department political fight. Both were traps that no cop near retirement wanted to be in the vicinity of. You stick your foot in it, and before you know it, you're on your own, in the wilderness, all by your lonesome, broke self, wondering where your pension went, all boiled up on Benzedrine and coffee, waiting for the political hacks at PBA to come cut you loose, which was like waiting for a herd of crocodiles. Dirt, he thought bitterly, staring through the windshield, like the beautiful cleaning woman, Sister G, from the church said, "You and I got the same job. We clean dirt." And dirt it was, he thought. And not just any dirt. New dirt surfacing. He could smell it, feel it coming, and it was big, whatever it was. The cause was changing. He could see the transformation everywhere. It was 1969. The New York Mets, once the laughing stock of Major League Baseball, would win the World Series in a week. America had landed a man on the moon in July, and the cause was falling apart. 1969. I'm going to call it, he thought bitterly. This is the year the cause falls to bits. He could see the disintegration. Old black tenants who had come to New York from the South decades ago were retiring or moving out to Queens. The lovable old drunks, bums, shoplifters, prostitutes, low-level, harmless, habitual criminals who had once brought him laughs and even solace in his long days as a patrolman and detective, were going, going, and soon to be gone, moving away, dying, disappearing, locked up. Young girls, who had once waved at him, had matured into unwed, drug addict mothers. A few had fallen into prostitution. Kids who used to joke with him on the way home from school as he patrolled in his car, pulling out trombones from instrument cases and blasting horrible music at his cruiser as it rolled past while he laughed, had vanished. The city was cutting music from the schools, someone said. Kids who had once bragged about their baseball games had become sullen and silent, the baseball fields empty. Just about every young kid who had once waved now walked the other way when his cruiser appeared. Even his old friend, Dub Washington, the hobo he had peeled off curbs around the neighborhood on countless cold nights, was worn by the change. He'd seen Dub 2 days ago, and the old wino bore awful news. He'd picked up Dub the day after the Vitali Pier shooting. Just routine. His usual once-a-month task of hauling him to nearby Sisters of Mercy on Willoughby Avenue, where the kind Catholic nuns fed him and let him shower and sent him on his way. Dub was harmless and always fun, a wonderful aficionado of city news. He claimed to be the only one in the cause houses who read the New York Times every day. But that day, Potts found the old man grim and shaken.
"I seen something bad," Dub said.
"Where?" Potts asked.
"Down at Vitali Pier. Two old fellas walked into a hot mess."
Dub explained what he'd seen. Young kids, a girl shooter, two old men, two young men. Two of them dropped. A third, maybe a fourth, fell into the harbor.
Who were they? Potts asked.
Spotcoat was one, Dub said. Hot Sausage the other.
That did it, Potts thought. That would wrap it up. He'd spent 2 weeks seeking information about the old man. Nobody knew anything, of course. They all deflected. Leave it to good old Dub to come up with some answers. It was old-time police work, an old source, developed over the years, paying off. There were puzzles here, of course. But as it worked out, Sportcoat apparently got the back end of what he delivered on the front. Of course he did. Don't these stories always end up that way? He'd tried to warn Sister G. Still, there were questions. Was this a drug war, or just a payback to even things out with the old man, and that was the end of it? He was just not sure. He'd taken Dub to the sisters and then sought a follow-up with the two shooting victims out at Maimonides Medical Center in Borough Park. For some reason, his request had been delayed several days. By then, the fourth person present at the shooting was assumed to be dead in the harbor, the body yet to appear. The girl hitman, if that's what she was, had long fled. This borough and this goddamned department, he thought bitterly, are changing too fast for me. They're both worse than they ever were. The new normal in the old Brooklyn, he decided, was heroin. There was so much money in it, it was unstoppable. How long would it take before the drugs plaguing the Negro in the cause houses would spread past the district to the rest of Brooklyn? Today, it was the Negroes in the cause and a few Italians from the surrounding blocks. Tomorrow, he thought. He was irritated and felt the need to move. He opened the cruiser's door and got out, leaving the engine running. He leaned one arm on the roof of the car and the other on the top of the open car door. From that position, he could see the boxcar in front of him, its dock, and Five Ends Baptist Church just a block away, easily seen above the high weeds of the bare lot next door. It had never occurred to him that the boxcar and the church, both located at the barren edges of the cause houses, were within sight of each other. One could go directly from one building to the next. They were so near each other. Yet, they were from two worlds. The boxcar of the proud Elefante family, old Guido, who staggered around with a gimpy arm and leg after his stroke, suffered while doing 12 years in Sing Sing for keeping his mouth shut, along with his slick, closed-mouth kid, Tommy, and the strange wife who wandered the lots looking for junk plants. And then the proud Negroes in their dilapidated old church with the gorgeous woman leader who loved dirt. He couldn't get her out of his mind. Sister G. Veronica G. Even the name sounded wonderful. Veronica. Sister Veronica. Like the Veronica in the Bible, who offered Jesus her veil to wipe his face with as he bore the cross to Calvary. Glorious. She could wipe his face with her cloth any time. He sighed. He imagined she was at work right now, her dark, regal face bent in concentration, dusting the halls of the handsome brownstone across the street from Radigan's, or maybe cleaning some snot-nosed kid's toilet, or dusting off a chandelier and thinking about all the things that dirt represented. "You and I got the same job," she'd said to him. "We clean dirt." "I need cleaning myself," he thought. "If I let her clean me the rest of my life, maybe I'd have a chance at happiness. But why would she bother?" He slammed the door of the cruiser and headed toward the boxcar just as Tommy Elefante emerged, hands in his pockets. He knew Elefante had spotted him on his first pass.
"What brings you to my dock, Potts?" Elefante said.
"Loneliness."
"Yours or mine?"
"Stop complaining, Tommy. At least you're rich."
Elefante laughed.
"That brings a lump to my throat, Potts."
Now it was Potts' turn to laugh. There were three makeshift stairs to the doorway where Elefante stood, a normal-sized door cut into the frame of the railroad car. Elefante took a seat on the top step above him. Potts noted that Elefante had carefully closed the door behind him. Clearly, Potts thought, he wasn't invited inside. Elefante seemed to read that thought.
I got a Ferrari inside, he said, nodding at the door behind him. I only let my closest friend see it.
How'd you get it in there?
Prayer and insurance, the only two things a good Catholic ever needs.
Potts smiled. He'd always liked Tommy Elefante. Tommy was like the father, but with words. Silent as old Guido was, there was a grim goodness to the old man, an honesty and sense of humor that Potts, despite himself, always appreciated. Both men, the cop at the bottom, the mobster at the top, looked out toward the harbor, watching the gulls skimming the water and gliding toward the Statue of Liberty shining in the dusky distance.
I haven't parked my Duff on this step in 20 years, Potts said. I didn't know you ever did. I talked to your father a lot in the old days. Got any more lies?
I broke his 6 words a day limit a couple of times. I ever tell you the story about how I met him?
If there's a story, Elefante said, it's one-sided. I'd walked the beat for 6 years, and finally they gave me my first squad car, Potts chuckled. It must have been, 1948.
There was a tip that old Guido Elefante, our local smuggler, just got out of jail, had a shipment of illegal cigarettes coming through his boxcar. On a certain night, at a certain time, you know the drill. Buy the cigarettes cheap in North Carolina, pull the tags, add new ones, sell them at 50% profit.
Is that how they did it?
Potts ignored the remark and continued.
They sent a squad down to bust the operation wide open. They were tired of him, I guess. Or maybe he hadn't greased somebody. Whatever the case, we had 3 squad cars and a sergeant. It must have been 3 or 4 in the morning. We swooped in here all piss and vinegar, lights flashing, making noise, the works. I was young and bothered in those days. Gung-ho. Still feeling my oats from the war. Finally had my own squad car. A cherry top, they called it. It was just so hot. We kicked in the door and got nothing. The place was dark. Guido was obviously home sleeping. So we left. The other 2 cars pulled out first. I was the last to leave. We often rode solo in those days, so I got in my car, and as I do, I see this guy running off the dock. Where he was hiding, I don't know. I don't even know why he was running, but I figured he was running from me. So I cranked the squad car to get him, and damn if the car wouldn't start. No kidding. That's the first thing they tell you. Don't shut the car off. So now I'm cooked, being a rookie. So I didn't radio ahead to the other 2 cars. There was a suspect on foot. Instead, I took off on foot after the guy. He was moving, but I was young then. I almost had him at Van Marl and Linder, but then he got an extra gear somewhere and pulled away and got a few yards on me. At the corner of Slag and Van Marl, I was gaining on him. Then, in the middle of the intersection, the gobshite turned around and pulled a gun on me. Pulled it out of nowhere. He had me dead to rights. And then this truck comes out of nowhere about 40 miles an hour. Boom! Ran him down in the intersection, killed him on the spot. The truck driver said, I never saw the guy. Never saw him. He was right. It was dark. The guy jumped into the intersection out of nowhere. No way the driver could have seen him. It was an accident. It happened fast. The truck driver kept apologizing. I said, it's okay. Hell, I was grateful. Anyway, I ran to a police phone around the corner to get help. When I came back, the truck was gone. All we could do was scrape the guy up off the ground and call the morgue. Well,
About 6 months later, they sent me over here again, saying they'd got this guy Guido for transporting some tractors or some such thing. So I drove over here in a rush again, this time, alone. But instead of transporting crap, I see a big front-end loader over there where your storage place is now. It's a big tractor that scoops up the dirt, and there's a guy in there working the thing.
He's got only one good hand and one good leg.
I get in close and look in the cab. It was the guy who was driving that truck. I said, "You're the truck driver." He didn't miss a beat. He said, "I never saw the guy. If you hadn't shut your motor off, the whole thing would have never happened." Potts chuckled. I think that was one of the two or three things Guido ever said to me. Elefante tried to stifle a grin, but he couldn't help himself. A lot of saints don't start out well, but they end that way. You saying he was a saint? Not at all, but he never forgot a face, and he was loyal. Aren't saints loyal? Speaking of saints, Pot said. He pointed to Five Ends Church. Know anybody there?
I see them from time to time. Nice people, never bother anybody.
I seem to recall a lady from there died in the harbor a couple of years ago.
Nice lady. Took a swim. Can't blame her, really.
That happened after I got transferred to the 103 in Queens, Pot said.
I never did hear how that movie ended,
Elefante said. It didn't end well.
Why's that?
Potts was silent a moment.
I'm retiring in 3 months, Tommy. I'll be out of your hair. Me too.
How's that?
Doesn't matter. I'm gone in about that time. Less if I can. I'm selling this place.
You in trouble?
Not at all. I'm retiring.
Potts ate that one for a long minute. He looked over his shoulder at Elefante. He was tempted to say, retiring from what? He'd heard criminals declare they would retire all the time. But Elefante was different. A smuggler, yes. Effective, yes. But a bad criminal? Potts wasn't sure what that was anymore. Elefante was surly, clever, unpredictable. Never moved the same thing twice in a short time period. Never seemed to get too greedy. Never moved drugs. He kept his storage place and normal shipments from his boxcar to cover his tracks. He greased the cops like the rest, but with an instinct for survival. And, Potts had to admit it, decency. He could smell a young, hungry cop and could sniff out a clean one, too. He never framed cops or cornered those on payola. He rarely asked for favors. It was just business to him. He was smart enough never to try to grease Potts or any of the few square cops Potts knew at the 7-6. That said a lot about Elefante. Still, Elefante was part of the family, and they did some terrible things. Potts tried to ferret out the difference between an unfair world and a terrible one. Thinking about it confused him. What difference did it make if a guy stole a dozen refrigerators and sold them for $5,000, as opposed to a guy who sold $50,000 worth of refrigerators and changed the tax code to help him make $80,000? Or a dope-dealing bum whose heroin destroyed entire families? Which one to turn a blind eye to, if any? I ought to be an ostrich, he thought bitterly, 'cause I don't give a damn. I'm in love with a dirt woman, and she doesn't know my heart. Through the blisters of thought, he saw Elefante watching him.
I hear guys say they'll retire all the time, he said finally. You never heard it here.
Is it hard on you out here? Potts asked, with all the changes?
There was the slightest twitch on Elefante's eyebrow.
A little. How about you?
Same here. But guys in my business retire.
They're doing mine, too.
How?
Rigor mortis?
Elefante smirked.
What do you want from me, Potts? You waiting on me to get sore eyelids from blinking too much?
I want out. I'm tired. I've been working all my life. You know, an oak tree doesn't produce acorns until they're over 50 years old.
So, you want to be an oak tree?
I want to be a guy that every cop in the 7-6 doesn't come see twice a year like the dentist.
I came here because I heard you want to see me.
Who told you?
I didn't call.
You're not the only one who's got birds crowing in the 7-6, Tommy. But if you're Tarzan, I'm Jane. I'm hearing things I don't understand about a case. I'm hoping you'll clear them up.
Is it really about a case?
God damn it, just because everyone in this precinct wants to skim his neighbor for a piece of bread doesn't mean I'm the same as them. Yes, it's really about a case. My last case, if I'm lucky. I come down here to talk to you square. Maybe you can clear some things up for me. Maybe I can do the same for you. Does that sound good? Then we can retire together.
We got competing interests, Potts.
How exactly I'm getting out is none of your affair. But I'm getting out. I already told you too much.
Don't get smart. I already know too much.
I'm not getting smart.
In my business, trouble creeps up on you like an old charge account. So you work it out with the guys who won't knife you in the back and hope the rest that you owe have amnesia. That's how it works. But where our interests connect, I'm interested in doing business.
Fair enough.
So,
what you got?
I got a dead kid at Vitali Pier, and two wounded, and an old man on the lam.
Who's the guy?
Potts looked at Elefante.
Come on, Tommy.
You ever think about it? That I might not know him? He works for your mother, for Christ's sakes.
Elefante sighed.
Come up to street level, would you? You know how she is. She's the same as she was when you first started kicking tail around here. She wanders around these empty lots looking for anything that doesn't smell like shit on a stick so she can stick it in my yard.
What's wrong with that?
You see the neighborhood? It's not safe around here no more.
Not even for her?
I don't know these new people, Potts. And I don't know that guy.
He was in your house.
He wasn't. He was in the yard for a few months, maybe 3 months, once a week, sticking plants in the ground. Old guy, called himself the deacon. They call him Sport Jacket or something. He's good with plants, can grow anything. Lots of families on my street used him.
So what's he sticking a burner in Deems's chest for?
I don't know, Potts. I was going to ask you.
You sound like some guy at a peace conference, Tommy. Potts said, exasperated. You're full of questions, with no answers.
And I'm telling you, I don't know the guy. I said a few words to the guy in 3 months. He worked in the yard. He grew whatever weeds my mother told him to grow. She paid him a little cash and he cut out. He's a drunk. One of those guys who dies at 20 and is buried at 80. He's a church guy, a deacon over at the church there.
What does a deacon do? Potts asked.
You're the second person that asked me that this week. How the fuck do I know? They sing songs, maybe, or give homilies to donkeys, or sleep like snails, or slobber while they collect church money and give out the hymnals.
So he drinks and grows plants and goes to church, Potts said.
So far, he sounds Catholic.
Elefante laughed.
I always liked you, Potts, even though you were a headache.
Were? Potts said.
You said you're getting out.
I am.
Maybe you can do me a favor then, 'cause I'm getting out too.
Are you lying, exaggerating, or just thinking big?
I'm telling you, I really am.
If you're trying to use that as an excuse to burn yourself out of whatever hole you've dug, it ain't gonna work, Tommy. I hear that all the time. But not from me. Potts was silent. Elefante, he thought, sounded serious.
Honest to God, Potts, I am getting out. My mother, she's getting up there, and I'm working on... Can you keep a secret? It'll brighten your day. I'm moving to the Bronx.
What for? The baseball team stinks.
That's my business. But I don't want to leave no debts behind. I want out clean. You know the people I work with. You know how they are. If you're worried about that, you should have picked better friends. Your buddy, Joe Peck's in trouble, by the way.
Elefante was quiet a moment.
You wired?
He asked.
Potts snorted. The only wire I wear is the one the captain uses to run up my ass. They hate me at the 7-6. Here's the truth, Tommy. Take it or leave it. If you're a cop, be a cop. If not, then be a square like me. Or be a bum like Peck. Or one of those dope runners selling crap to these kids. There's no in-between. The Gorvinos are so busy selling dope to the Negroes with one hand and saluting the flag with the other, they can't see what's coming. Their kids are gonna be dope addicts. You'll see. You think the Negroes around here are stupid? They got guns and like money, too. It's not the good old days, Tommy. It's not like it was.
Potts felt his anger surging and tried to control it.
I'm not going out like the old guys before me, he said, mad and pissed and screwed.
He glanced at the church, and again he thought of Sister G. At the moment she seemed distant, a far-off dream. Then he said it.
I think it's a woman, he said, not your gardener. If it was me, I'd move to the Bronx for a woman.
Elefante didn't reply. Potts changed the subject.
The shooting at the pier. You know anything about that girl?
Elefante shook his head. Potts sighed.
There's an old bum I know who stays around the paint factory at Vitale Pier, he said. He more or less lives there. You know him. Dub, they call him. I seen him around.
Old Dub was sleeping off a binge that night, right beneath the first floor window, fighting it out with the rats. He woke up to some talking on the dock, peeked out the window and saw what happened, saw the whole thing. I picked him up for vagrancy and a shower the next day. For a $4 bottle of wine, he spilled everything he saw.
Was it good wine?
It was my $4, damn good wine.
Then it was money well spent.
Potts sighed. Now I've shared my song. You got one to share?
I can't do that, Potts. I don't mind kicking around a few scruples to make a living, but talking to cops can make a guy keel over, and not from old age.
I understand, but let me ask you this. There's a colored fella out in Bed-Stuy, smart fella, name of Moon. Bunch Moon. That name sound familiar?
It might.
Do the Gorvinos know that name?
They oughta,
Elefante said. Potts nodded. That was enough. He placed his hat on his head. If you're gonna retire, this will be a good time. Because when things get rolling, it won't be pretty.
They're already rolling.
Elefante said.
See? I told you it won't be pretty. But the girl is. What girl?
Don't play dumb, Tommy. I'm giving you some skin here. It's a girl. A Negro girl. A shooter. A good one. For hire. From out of town. That's all I know. She's a looker. And she's got a name like a man. Shoots like a man, too. Your buddy Peck ought to watch himself. Bunch Moon is ambitious.
What's her name?
If I told you, I'd hate myself in the morning. Especially if I have to drag her out of the harbor.
I got no bone to pick with any girl.
What's in a name, anyway? Potts stood up. This interview was finished. When you retire to the Bronx, Tommy, would you send me a card?
I might.
What you gonna do when you retire?
I'm going fishing.
What about you?
Potts asked.
I'm gonna make bagels. Potts stifled a smile.
You're Italian, in case you forgot.
Grazie. But since when did that monkey stop the show?
Elefante said.
I'll take what I can get. That's the thing when you get out and you're still breathing. Every day is a new world.
Potts glanced at Five Ends Baptist Church down the street. The lights were on. In the distance he heard singing. Choir practice. He thought of a lovely woman sitting at the front of the choir pew, dangling her house keys in her hand as she sang. He sighed.
I understand, he said.
Chapter 22 281 Delphi. The brownstone at 281 Delphi Street, near the corner of Cunningham Avenue, sat hunched and alone, with weeded lots on both sides. It was the perfect defensive spot. Inside on the second floor, Bunch Moon sat near a window, staring at the street below. From his position, he could see anyone who turned the corner and approached. Children played in the hulks of the cars on the street. It was an unusually warm October day, and the kids had opened the fire hydrant again. He made a note to pull his dilapidated pickup truck up to the hydrant later to let the kids make a few quarters washing it. There were a couple, he had noticed, and they were almost ready for employment. He opened the window and peered out, looking to the right, then left, then right again. The right was not a problem. He could see several blocks clear down to Bedford Avenue. To the left was trickier. Delphi Street came to a T at the corner. He had wanted a house on a dead-end street, but when he first came to look for a secret meeting place on that deserted block, there were so many boarded-up, empty brownstones, he'd had his choice of several along that street, and he decided the block would work fine. He'd chosen 281 because it had a better view of approaching traffic than any other house. To the right, he could see anyone coming down from Bedford for blocks. To the left, the T formed at an empty weeded lot, with several dilapidated houses to the left of the intersection that he could not see. To the right of that, within view, was an abandoned warehouse that he could only see part of. Whoever came down that side street from the right, if they came in a car, would be in sight for about 10 feet before they turned into Delphi Street and could make a rush up his steps. It wasn't ideal, but the spot worked. It was as close to a lookout spot as he could get without attracting attention from the cops. He rarely drove there. He usually took the subway. He always wore an MTA uniform, so the neighbors believed he was a transit worker as he moved in and out. Few of his crew or his employees who processed his raw heroin shipments knew about 281. It was safe. Still, he could never be too careful. Standing at the window, he took one long look in both directions. When he was satisfied, he ducked his head back inside and closed the window. He sat down at his dining room table, glanced at the headlines of the New York Times, the Daily News, and the Amsterdam News that lay before him, then at the pretty young woman across the table. She was regarding her nails. Harold Dean, the Death Queen, was in the same spot where Earl, that low-down, grizzled-faced, stupid son-of-a-bitch snitch, had sat. She was working at her nails with a nail file. He stifled an impulse to curse at her and then said,
"How'd you get here?"
"The bus."
"You ain't got a car?"
"I don't drive."
"How do you get around in Virginia?"
"That's my business."
"You fucked up bad. You know that, right?"
"I did my best. What happened was unavoidable."
I ain't paying for that.
I'll fix it. I need the money. I'm going to college.
Bunch snorted.
Why are you wasting your talent?
Harold Dean took that in silence as she continued to work on her nails. He neglected to mention that he'd taken advantage of her other talents when she was 14, living on a street just like this one, with her mother, hauling everything they owned in shopping carts from place to place. He continued, "The basement door leads to the backyard. At the end of the fence there, if you push on it, it's a gate. Leave here that way."
"All right," Harold Dean said.
"Where you staying?"
"With my mother in Queens."
"That ain't smart for a college girl."
Harold Dean worked her nails in silence. He neglected to mention, she noted, that her mother was busy cooking heroin with baking soda, flour, and water in one of his processing houses out in Jamaica. He thought she didn't know. He also thought she didn't know that he'd taken advantage of her mother's talents, too, back in the day, when her mother was young. But that, she thought bitterly, was how she'd survived. Pretending not to know. Pretending to be dumb. A dumb cutie. Fuck being dumb. She was done with it.
"I'm gonna study accounting," she said.
Bunch laughed.
"You'd be better off learning to milk a camel. There's no money in that."
Harold Dean said nothing. She pulled a bottle of nail polish from her purse and started to paint her nails. She hadn't been comfortable with the hit on those two boys. They weren't grown-up, hardened men like Bunch, men who knew the game and who had done so much to her when she was young and pretty beyond her years, with her long hair and milky brown skin and thick legs, wandering around with her shy, gentle mother who pushed their things about in a shopping cart after her father died, the guys squeezing her mother's tits for a quarter and letting dope dealers use Harold Dean as a whore and a lure to set up drug robberies.
"Bunch saved us,"
her mother liked to say. But that was her mother's way of processing pain. It was the daughter who saved them, they both knew. The social worker who helped them said it best. Harold Dean had read the social worker's report after she left New York. "The daughter raised the mother," the lady wrote, "not the other way around." Her saving came with a price. Every bit of hair on Harold Dean's pretty head, care of her handsome Dominican father and pretty African-American mother, had vanished. At 20, she had been bald. Her hair just fell out one day, a result she assumed of the difficult life she had lived. She wore a wig now, and long sleeves to cover her back, shoulders, and upper arms, which were burned, care of a job that had gone horribly wrong 2 years ago. Nothing was certain now, except for her lovely apartment in Richmond and the medicine she occasionally ate at night to keep the howls of the men she killed out of her dreams. They were horrible sons of bitches, men who set upon one another with welding torches, scorched each other with hot irons, and poured Clorox into one another's eyes for the sake of dope. Men who made their girlfriends do horrible things, servicing 4 or 5 or 8 men a night, who made their women do push-ups over piles of dog shit for a hit of heroin until, exhausted, the girls dropped into the shit so the men could get a laugh. These were the men her mother allowed in her life. Her stay with her mother was more out of a sense of duty than anything else. She bought her mom some food, gave her a little money, but the two hardly spoke anymore.
"I'll make enough money in accounting. I'm a saver."
"How's your ma doing these days?"
Bunch asked. As if he didn't know, Harold Dean thought. She shrugged.
"What's that got to do with the price of tea in China?"
"You sound like a college kid already. Can you count your fingers and toes, too?"
Harold Dean considered this thoughtfully for a moment, then said,
I have to leave in 2 days. I'll finish by then. After that, I'm heading home.
What's the hurry?
I got another job in Richmond.
What kind of job?
I don't ask your business, she said.
I'm the one paying.
I ain't seen a dime yet, she said. Not even train fare. Bunch pushed back from the table.
You're awful loose around the mouth for someone who